everyone. Welcome to another episode of Sit Still, Look Opinionated, the podcast. I'm your host, Claire Malky. So I probably don't have to remind you that the election day is quickly approaching. With that ever-present fact circling around, have you made a plan to vote? Whether you're voting early, dropping off your mail-in ballot, or actually mailing your ballot, make sure you plan ahead and read the fine print. From personal experience, my ballot almost couldn't be counted because I didn't answer a question about how long I've lived at my current address. Luckily, a poll worker pointed out my error. I am forever grateful. In total, make a plan, read the fine print, and get to the polls. I hear it's what all the opinionated people are doing nowadays. We have got an excellent show in store for you all today. We're continuing our conversation about RBG, and we're switching it up this week and releasing our extended interview with Professor of American History, Patty Farless. No headlines this week, though. We figured between the talks of Amy Coney Barrett and the possible outcomes of the election, we're hitting you with enough topical news stories. With all that in mind, grab your notorious drink of choice. You know mine is a margarita. And let's get started. This week's episode of Sit Still, Look Opinionated is brought to you by Theater in the Dark, A War of the Worlds, a virtual audio drama. A link to tickets will be listed in the show notes.
No one would have believed.
You see this? What's happening in the suburbs?
In the first years of the 21st century.
Wi-Fi's not working.
That this world was being watched keenly and closely.
What's happening?
By intelligences greater than our own.
That's in Kankakee. We should drive out and see it.
Careful. Don't get too close.
Dr. Pearson, have there been fresh attempts to signal these beings?
This October.
It's something more than a meteorite.
Theater in the Dark presents...
It's a cylinder.
And it's opening.
A War of the Worlds. A virtual audio drama performed live every night over Zoom. Pay what you can tickets available now at theaterinthedark.com.
And now my interview with Professor of American History, Patty Farless. So for today's interview, we have Patty Farless. She is a senior instructor at the University of Central Florida and has taught for over 20 years and has taught courses in American history, U.S. women's history, and has conducted research in constitutional history. Thank you so much for being on Sit Still, Look Opinionated.
I'm excited to be here. Thank you for asking me. This is wonderful.
Yes, of course. We're always happy to have professors on the show. It really helps us round out our research. So to give us a little bit of background about how you came into history, could you tell us how you first got started and your story in those lines?
Sure. Well, I didn't plan on doing gender history or women's history. I was more interested in the 14th Amendment. I wanted to do more work in that area. It had piqued my interest the most, which is ironic because I really don't spend a lot of time on it anymore in the late 20th and early 21st century. But I went to one of my, at the time, who became my thesis advisor. And I said, this is what I want to do my thesis on, the 14th Amendment. You know, you always have students say, I want to do it on the history of history, you know, all history from start till finish. And so you always have to start to kind of give some focus and angle. So she asked me, she said, well, have you thought about doing it on the role of women in the 14th Amendment, the impact of it? And so that's how the story began. That's what I ended up doing my thesis on. I looked at the origins of the 14th Amendment, the beginnings of it, and the impact it had on the women's rights movement in the 19th century, and then the lasting impact it's had up until, at that time, it was the 1990s.
That's amazing. To give our listeners a little bit of perspective, if they don't remember what the 14th Amendment is off the top of their head, could you go into a little bit about what that is?
You're speaking my language. I'm happy to talk about it all day long. So at the end of, well, and even before the end of the Civil War, one of the things that happened was, of course, we saw the abolishment of slavery with the 13th Amendment, you know, which once ratified, abolished it, you know, all throughout, including in the states that remained in the Union. And the question, though, was what would be the citizenship of newly freed slaves? And if you go to an earlier decision, the Dred Scott decision, very simply, free blacks did not even have constitutional rights. They were not citizens. And so the 14th Amendment sought to address some of that issue. There was also, so when you read the 14th Amendment, you'll hear this in issues with immigration and what have you, some of the questions and the challenges to it, but it'll read all persons born or naturalized in the United States are citizens thereof. And so what it does is it takes this, the idea of what does it take to be a citizen? Well, you're born or you're naturalized and you're a full citizen. So the question for women was, of course, what would that entail? And there is a provision that's in the 14th Amendment as well that speaks to who should be voting and if they're not allowed to vote. And I'm roughly paraphrasing that the states would face penalties, and it speaks to a class of male, you know, certain classes of male citizens. And of course, that was the first time gender had been injected into the Constitution. Until that point, it was gender neutral. So it was referenced three times, and then three times it was referenced in who should be voting, and if they're not voting, states would face penalties. So that's a really rough paraphrase of it, but that starts the issue for many of the women's rights activists who had been working on, you know, helping to preserve the Union and fighting for the Union through different means in terms of campaigning and all sorts of other ways they were supporting the Union. And also they were supporting the Republican Party at the time, which was the newer party. And very simply, they felt this was quite the, the slap in the face to them because they had put their efforts toward it. So that begins kind of a very, and we could have a long story about this that could go on for hours, that begins this relationship with gender and women specifically, what is going to be their rights under the 14th Amendment. And that is one of the areas that in terms of our talk that Ruth Bader Ginsburg spends enormous amounts of time working on and handling, because that is governing the states. So the 14th Amendment is saying all persons born or naturalized are citizens of the United States. And then it guarantees certain things that they cannot be denied their privileges and immunities. They can't be denied their life, liberty, or property without due process, and they can't be denied equal protection. And that is addressing the states because these provisions are already in the Fifth Amendment. Mm-hmm. So what happens is if states are passing laws that are seen as denying citizens their equal protection or their due process, these laws can and are often challenged. And that is where a heart of the bulk of fighting that goes on in terms of political battles is trying to, depending on your political affiliation, your states trying to get them to be more conservative in how they interpret the 14th Amendment and laws that they're applying and passing. And also if you're in a more progressive or liberal, certainly trying to make a broader argument for protections of the 14th Amendment. Mm-hmm. So that is a long answer, but you hopefully gave you a sense of what the 14th Amendment does. It protects you and me in theory from states that are trying to deny us either equal protections or deny us our due process.
From the research that we've been doing, the 14th Amendment has had a big impact on Ruth Bader Ginsburg's proceedings and some other Supreme Court proceedings as well.
Sure.
So I kind of wonder, could you speak to a little bit about how and why Ruth Bader Ginsburg came to be such a big proponent for equal rights, and anything that you can speak of from your knowledge about why that's had such a lasting impact in America?
So I think with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, as with any person that is probably inclined to solve problems within society through the law. And I think with her, that was, you know, the tool or vehicle that she saw as, you know, the instrument that she could see important changes that took place in society. And I think with her as well, if you consider her generation. And I think this is a very important part for us, right? The generation issue is going to be a problem, you know, in terms of this generation will get ready to experience a very different, perhaps a very different America than what we've been living through, you know, for the 50, 60 years that we've seen impacts by the civil rights movement and the women's rights movement. So I think with her, and certainly, you know, she was able to go to law school, but there were very few that were able to. Her presence was questioned. I think someone like that would see this as, you know, that had that drive of change, and that her vehicle for change would be, in fact, through the law. And this brings up a good point and I think a question, mm-hmm. because if you think about it at the time, the Equal Rights Amendment is also making progress. And part of the issues of the time, mm-hmm. in terms of stymieing the Equal Rights Amendment, was that there was progress being made through the 14th Amendment for women. And so that you can't take and look at the 14th Amendment in modern era without thinking about the Equal Rights Amendment and vice versa, right? Mm-hmm. So part of the argument becomes of not pushing further for the Equal Rights Amendment because change was already happening in the 14th Amendment. So that's something we have to think about. But to go back to your previous point or question, with her, I think you're seeing at that time that awakening among women who were questioning that their society had become fairly conservative, because it did become more conservative than it had been earlier in the century. And that the laws that they were living under and their own expectations, and this often happens with social movements. The social movements of that time, of course, the civil rights movement, the, you know, the anti-war movement, it's going to spill over into mm-hmm. questions about other ideas of equality and rights and what does it mean to be in a country and freedom. But she, like many of her generation and slightly earlier, were very influenced also by what the impact of both a world war would have, that legacy with, even though she was later, but that legacy, the influence over her family, certainly her own religious background. And I think all of that comes together into living in a society that certainly was blatantly unequal mm-hmm. and uneven. And with that, you have, of course, the civil rights movement and challenging many of the laws that were happening in terms of cases. And then you also have her being involved as well in starting to move that legal challenge also to a broader women's rights challenge and women's equality challenge. Hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And I think that's something that in history I tend to sometimes neglect, is that history is not just this one moment, a day in a textbook. There's a whole influence that's been happening in society, culturally, what's going on to lead up to that moment and why the history and why that challenge was made in the first place. And in speaking of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, it seems that her movement and her ideals and like from what she had been doing with like the ACLU and those things, like those were something that was pushing her forward, and not just because she thought of it in the first place. Like there had been a whole movement before her that led to that movement. If that's not really a question so much as more of a...
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I think you're hitting exactly on it. You know, there is, you know, in terms of, you know, feminist theory, we do look at the intersectionalities of discrimination, but systems of power and also systems of privilege, if you want to reverse that. Mm-hmm. But I think more broadly, we can't talk about, you know, the fights for gender equality without talking about the fights for racial equality, right?
Yeah.
And we can't talk about the fights for racial equality without also speaking to the fights for gender equality. They are intertwined, and they have been historically in our legal system from the get-go. And, you know, rooting them out is, it's not that it's impossible. It's just that it will be incredibly difficult, and it's going to take generations upon generations of progress. Because one of the problems we have is, of course, we also, besides having progress, we also recede, right? We also have these more swings towards a conservatism, you know, much more swings towards, you know, away from social equality, gender equality, those types of things. And that takes decades to manifest, right? That takes decades to reach its fruition. And certainly one of the things we're living in right now is the backlash to the liberal movements of the middle and, you know, third quarter of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you start looking at the rise of the modern right, and now we have a new modern right, the rise of the modern right, we can look back to the Civil Rights Act of 1964, right?
Yeah.
We can look back to, you know, and draw a line from there and Roe v. Wade, right, to the rise of a modern right. And one of the things that the conservative movement has gotten right is they started working on it at the state by state level and at the local level and then at the congressional level. And so they have been laying the groundwork for 50 years to challenge laws that they in fact thought were violations of their society, you know, their social beliefs and how they envision society should be and what they believe should be the use of the law and so on. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, I know that they're among the progressives or liberal wings of our society. There's enormous amounts of both despair and energy, right? But it's going to take time.
Yeah.
And trying to keep, you know, if that's what you want to see reach its fruition through a court system or what have you, should all go as it's looking like, that President Trump will be able to appoint and achieve approval of a conservative justice to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you're looking at perhaps a couple of decades before the court will change again. Mm-hmm. I know it's not going to make my progressive or liberal friends happy with this, but, you know, since this happened, and it doesn't mean that I don't have the deepest respect and absolute admiration with Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Absolutely. My gosh, I'm sitting here because of the work she did and the work of many others. I think we also have to remember, we can't just focus on one person, right? We have to focus on, you know, the other people involved in the type of work that she was involved in.
Right.
But I do believe she made a mistake by not retiring during the Obama administration before 2014, because at that time, I think she was already at that point 80 or right around that. And, you know, if you want to see your legacy last, right? And she knew more than anyone that the pendulum, as she would refer to it, swung, right? Mm-hmm. But understanding the political cycles, you know, we knew that there would be a rise of a more conservative Senate. You have to look at where the states are that they're being replaced, right? You know, if it's states that are more, tend to be red or more conservative, however you want to put it, you can pretty much figure in that cycle, you're going to have a conservative Senate. And we could talk about, well, they shouldn't have done this, or, you know, we could talk about a lot of these things, but politics is a pretty nasty, pretty dirty place in terms of voting and elections, but we wouldn't have it any other way, right? We wouldn't want to be in a place where it's not, you know, we may not want the, you know, the hard knuckled fighting that goes on, but we want to have access to expressing our, you know, our differences, right? We want to have that. And democracy is a messy, very messy concept and practice. And so yet we don't always have the patience for that part of it.
I was reading about how there were some other members of like the Democratic Party who had been, you know, pushing for Ruth Bader Ginsburg to retire, and I wasn't aware of that at the time, and now I'm kind of having to like wrestle with this idea of like, is it right to, you know, think that only one person can do the job, or to build that legacy and to, you know, it makes me wonder, like, is or was she as like liberal as people make her out to be? Whereas I've also been doing some reading that said that she, you know, she had this friendship with, you know, Antonin Scalia, and that she was originally appointed as a moderate and then became more of the liberal vote. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that a little bit, and about maybe why that happened or your thoughts on that?
So I think there's always a certain amount of, I think you don't rise to the top of your profession, you know, and not have a certain amount of ego, right? I think there, you know, and she had, you know, and rightfully so, right? Yeah. She deserved to be, you know, someone who would say, you know, you're not going to tell me when to go. I think something also to think about, and this is purely conjecture on my part. I don't have any insight, but something to think about is, well, how difficult was the 2008 primary, right? Where, you know, issues of race or issues of gender or sex, it's really sex because it's dealing with the biology, but how much did that ruffle her feathers, right? Or, you know, cause her to feel like, you know, there was an older woman, you know, at the time who was treated very, very badly. And so I'm not going to let, you know, I don't know, this is purely conjecture on my part. Mm-hmm. But I know people that if you look at some of the history of, as I mentioned at the beginning, the 14th Amendment, and with that, the 15th Amendment, it ends up splitting the abolitionists from a part of the women's rights movement. And the women's rights movement ends up splitting over the 14th, really the 15th Amendment, but the 14th Amendment precipitates this because they're being forced to say, okay, I can support the 15th Amendment without women being added as a protected class, or I don't support the 15th Amendment and African-American men do not get the vote either. And it really was a very, very difficult and contested and splintering, that's not really the way, but it ends up splintering old allies with each other. Mm-hmm. And some of that resurfaced in the 2008, and I would say again and also in 2016, not so much the issue of race, but certainly the issue of gender. And part of me wonders, you know, did that have an impact? Was that something that she was mindful of and did not want to be also pushed around by people? You know, and again, I'm guessing, you know, but I don't think you can know history without seeing some of that sense of it. And certainly someone who lived through and made history, not emerging as a person that would be very mindful of both, you know, of you know, all kinds of discrimination, but, you know, certainly had experienced gender discrimination herself more specifically, if mm-hmm. that makes sense. You know, why was she made that decision? You know, I don't know that we know yet on that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think that's probably hard to even say about any historical figure, why they did something maybe that was tied to, you know, their emotions or what have you. But you know, as we do know, her seat is now open. Can you talk a little bit about maybe the historical precedent of filling a seat during an election year or things along those lines?
Well, again, I don't think I'm going to make my liberal or progressive friends very happy, but, you know, to the victor goes the spoils. And so give you a little bit of historical background. Let's say, for example, they're not able to get the nomination through and approved before the election. Mm-hmm. There is history of resentment, but it would be resentment of having someone appointed between, you know, the election and inauguration. And of course that was, you can go all the way back to the 1800 election between Adams and Jefferson. Mm-hmm. And Adams, of course, continued to essentially do appointments all the way up until, you know, the very last minute. That's why they call them the midnight appointments, until inauguration, right? So that said, and that of course leads to one of the most important decisions, which is Marbury v. Madison. Mm-hmm. That said, I mean, it, you know, if the person's confident, right, then you don't have really a reason to challenge it, that's, you know, you could argue, though, the people, and this is what Jefferson's view was, the people had already spoken, right? They spoke at the election. They wanted the country to go in a different direction, and that, you know, with different policies and different ideas. You can't then go back and say it, you would be thwarting the will of the people, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. And that would be counter to, of course, democracy. That's all nice and good, but, you know, who's in power gets to make those decisions and choices. Now, I think a couple of things you could think about is if there's any way that there's a you know, quid pro quo, especially if the Supreme Court has to weigh in on the decision, then certainly there becomes grounds for impeachment and things like that, of course, of a justice. So that would be something that would be possible. And, you're looking at someone who was very upset and very angered over the refusal to even give Merrick Garland, an up or down vote.
Yeah.
But that said, you know, we may have these norms that we practice, right? We may have what we feel are the, you know, what are not necessarily in the letter of the law, but we feel that is in the spirit of the law. You know, that is different than what can you actually do, right? Yeah. And Mitch McConnell has the keys, you know, and Donald Trump has the keys. And I really think this brings me back to a point where we started. You know, elections have consequences. Mm-hmm. They have very significant consequences. And I mean, it could be wrong, but I believe we're going to see a very different world coming. You know,
yeah.
There's plenty of history where we make progress in certain things. I mean, we have the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments passed and ratified, you know, in the 19th century. And yet we have to pass a Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Why? Well, because very simply, you may have thought you solved those problems in the 1860s, 1870s, but actually solving them, right? Or actually making progress that is continuous is very, very difficult to do. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I do believe we still make more progress than we recede, but I think we also have to be mindful that progress is never a guarantee. It is not something to take lightly. We shall see what ends up playing out. But I do think that they're going to be able to get their Supreme Court justice through. The one I'm most interested in, I'll be honest with you,
yeah,
is Anthony Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
Resigning rather out of nowhere. Did have health issues that, I mean, you know, beyond what we all have with our age. I've been very curious about this one.
Mm-hmm.
And again, speculation.
Yeah.
So historians aren't supposed to speculate, but since this is not for history, but I am very curious as to why that happened. And because Anthony Kennedy, in many ways, I know we're talking about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but I want to just say real quick,
yeah.
When you go back and you look at the swing vote between the liberal wing of the court and the more conservative wing, it was at least 7 or 8 out of 10 times Anthony Kennedy. And that one, and I would say, of course, the loss of Ruth Bader Ginsburg to a conservative justice. Those were critical. Both of these were critical.
Mm-hmm.
When you have that happening, then your court has tilted not just a little to the right, it's tilted significantly to the right. And many people say, well, does that mean Roe v. Wade? And I have a friend of mine that's an attorney, and she says, no way that's going to happen. I said, yes way, that's going to happen. And we're kidding ourselves. They may not do it all, you know, the first time around, but there, as I said, this has been something that has been part of the conservative movement, even prior to Roe v. Wade, but, you know, you can go back to Griswold v. Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say one of the things that was interesting to bring it back to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, one of her approaches that I thought was really always very interesting and important is recognizing that gender discrimination has impacts more than women, right?
Yeah.
It has an impact on men as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I always say to my young students, well, if you're a young man and you marry a woman, you're okay with getting only 75% of what her colleague makes, right? So 25% less in your household. Mm-hmm. Are you okay with that? And then you kind of, you start to see students say, well, wait a minute. That would affect, I said, yes, it might affect how many games you can buy if you're a big gamer, or your vacations, or whatever it might be. So when you start thinking about it in that way, and I think that's where she was brilliant, was being able to speak to it as not just a problem for women, but a problem for men too. And so when we start thinking about the erosion to contraceptives, we start rights, we start thinking about further erosion of Roe v. Wade. Given the technology that we have of being able to trace, right, who is the responsible party in terms of also the father, mm-hmm. and the fact that your family law has changed so dramatically to have men be also responsible for children, right? Much more so than the legal system used to be. That is also going to have an impact, not just for women and women's rights, but it's going to have an impact on men as well. And so I think it's important, in that sense of her lasting legacy, if we can think about and talk about these issues, not just as women's rights, not that there's anything wrong with talking about, it's women's rights, so what? It's my rights. But in the broader picture of it, being able to speak to these issues as impacting all of us, that's when we are able to see courts and the law itself respond. But you have people that are they want to interpret it from, a perspective of the 18th century.
Yeah.
So that's a challenge.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but the belief of feminism is for equality for all, for, men and women. And it's about, just that. I think I remember reading about one of RGB's cases where a man had custody of his child, but wasn't given, the proper money allocation because his partner hadn't died or something along those lines. And that really does put it into the perspective of rights for men as well, and making mm-hmm. that sort of clarification.
Yeah, the Frontero case that she wrote, mm-hmm. That was dealing with the Air Force and dealing with the woman who was she was making more, the wife who was making more mm-hmm. than her husband because he was still going to school, and she was a second lieutenant in the Air Force. And they were allowed to have, spouses were allowed to receive additional housing expenses and also other expenses they were allowed to receive money for. Without question, if it was a husband versus a wife, and the wife, if the husband did not make enough money to be 50% of his expenses, well, he made a little bit more than that, mm-hmm. but that same rule was not being applied to, obviously, male members of the Air Force. And, that was one of the most important cases in many ways that she was able to achieve. And again, it kind of goes back to that point. Are you okay with your household not getting this money because your wife or your, in the case of fathers to daughters, their daughters being discriminated against? And I think that was one of the most important cases in that sense. So taking a case on like that, you're fighting for a woman to receive the same benefits and not be discriminated against, but being able to pick a case that demonstrate not its impact on a single woman, right? But that it also impacted a family, mm-hmm. right? And so being able to craft and pick the right cases is also an important gift. And I think she certainly had that gift, that talent, because you could pick cases that were certainly cases that would, fall apart and bomb. Mm-hmm. So she had that talent for sure. And, I think to be fair, the nation and the courts do not, as much as they'd like to say, we're not part of society in that sense, and we're not, you know, influenced by politics. Of course they are. Mm-hmm. Of course they are, right? I mean, you go back to John Marshall and Marbury v. Madison, you know, you had the Democrat Republicans cutting back the size of the courts and, you know, having Supreme Court right circuit and what have you again. So yes, of course they're aware of it. And they know they have to thread those needles. And so, of course, in the 70s, you know, this is the decade of the woman. This is, you know, when you have the women's liberation movements going on. So that is permeating. It's making its way into the courts, right? It's influencing their decision making. Mm-hmm. You also have, you know, a much more moderate Republican Party in the 70s and 60s and 50s. And that had an impact. I mean, when you think of the Republican Party today, it is so much more to the right than of the center. And the Democratic Party is too. And what's happening within the Democratic Party, there's an attempt to try to correct it, to move it back to a more progressive liberal and away from a centrist Democratic Party. So, you know, that's something to be, you know, obviously to think about too, is how do you achieve change? Mm-hmm. You achieve change through consensus. It may not be popular, but you achieve change through consensus. And somehow we've created in our politics, you know, the idea that compromise is a nasty word. Mm-hmm. Well, compromise just means you didn't get all your, you know, everything your way, right? That's what it means. And our, you know, if you want to hark back to our founders, they didn't mean for us to get it all our way, one way or the other, right? They wanted a consensus. They wanted us to work through that. But I do think, you know, as you brought up, she was not necessarily meant to be as far perceived as far left. But when the court itself is moving so much further right, mm-hmm. you know, she's going to stake out a much, much more further left, you know, in terms of role. And also, I think, with society and its expectations had moved so much more significantly to the left, mm-hmm. which is ironic. Our politics is moving to the right, and yet our society is moving to the left, which is interesting in itself.
Yeah, I often wonder about that, about what if they are of the people and that notion, why is there that disconnect? But I had a different question about the Supreme sure. Court. Is in the way the Supreme Court was built or in its original functions, is it supposed to be, you know, bipartisan or, you know, half conservative, half liberal, or does it really all depend on, you know, who has the keys, as we had mentioned earlier? I don't quite know much about that, so I want to hear your thoughts on it.
So, you know, when the Constitution was created, they didn't have political parties. They didn't want political parties, but political parties emerged very quickly. So what they were more focused on was ensuring, you know, we always hear the separation of powers, but it's also sharing of power, right? That was the idea. There, no one person has the key, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like the nuclear submarine. You've got two people that have the key to launch, right? So the idea was you would have two branches of your government, you know, or at least half of another branch making this decision. And so in that sense, the appointment to the Supreme Court could not be as ideological. At least that was the belief in it. It becomes politicized very quickly, mm-hmm. without question. The midnight appointments right off the bat, you know, politicizes it because you're packing people in, right, that will be there for decades. And it didn't really matter whether they were qualified. All that mattered was they had a Federalist, you know, they were associated with the Federalists, mm-hmm. which, you know, to Jefferson, you didn't do that once the election was held. The people had spoken. So in our modern era, you know, I always say, be careful making changes, right? You know, because there's going to be a point where you're not in power. So you start to see efforts on the Republican Party, you know, going back to George W. Bush to make changes to the requirements for nominating judges, you know, instead of 60, it'd be simple majority, 51 votes. And with that 60 votes, it, you know, it does force you to create a little bit more consensus of course, the Republicans didn't use that because they were able to gain seats in the next midterm election. But then the Democrats are finding themselves being stymied once Obama was in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, President Obama's nominations to many of the different posts were not being put in for up or down vote.
Yeah.
So the Democrats pulled the trigger on it. They decide to make it a simple majority. Now, it didn't impact the Supreme Court, but the precedent's already set.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, you have to be careful with the changes you make to the system. And again, it goes back to this idea of trying to work within, being willing to have work through consensus, right? No, you're not going to get, if you're a liberal, you're not going to get, you know, the most liberal person found in America to serve on the court. Okay. But do you get someone who is going to interpret the law in a way that is more open to the principles and values of what you're wanting America to move for? Mm-hmm. And the same for Republicans, you know, and of course the issue now is there's nothing to change. There's nothing to make a change that says if Republicans lose in November, they can't make the change and say it's going to take a supermajority to get a nominee in and pass a law before, you know, pass a rule before they step out of power. Mm-hmm. You know, and we could sit here and talk about the politicization of the court, but it's always been there. I mean, you go back to the court packing plan of FDR.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm not one that thinks that it's a horrible thing to have more judges on there. Again, it might force you to have greater consensus, but I don't think this is why you do it. Right. You don't do it just because, you know, in this case, RBG did not make it until a new president was put in office. Mm-hmm. That's not why you do it. You do it if there's a need for the caseload. You do it if you're thinking that you could create a more diverse, and I'm not saying to water down or dilute the conservatives on the court. I'm saying if you feel that, to create more discussions within the court and somehow or another adding, you know, five more justices would do that, okay. But you need to be able to lay that argument out to the American people, and you need to be able to get the American people to say, yeah, I agree with you. Mm-hmm. And despite the blowback on FDR, I think the American people would have agreed with him. And again, that doesn't always mean that you're right too to do it, because just because the American people at the time are in favor does not mean that's something you should do. You should always be careful of breaking whatever are the norms and the practices that you have, because they're not going to be there when you're out of power. Mm-hmm. In terms of the politicization, you know, we could talk about a thousand things on that, right? What created it? I think Bush v. Gore did not do us, you know, it did not do the court, you know, any favors. It may have accomplished an immediate goal, mm-hmm. but it did not truly do the court itself a favor. And I think John Roberts is aware of that idea,
yeah.
of being able to protect and defend what is seen as the independence of the court. Mm-hmm. That said, I don't know where, you know, how much power he'll be able to wield as a chief justice if the majority of his court are, in fact, very conservative and are ready to walk away from previous decisions. People will say, oh, it's settled law. There's no such thing as settled law. It doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm. Like, it can
law changes. It's dynamic.
Yeah. It can be changed.
You know, you have Plessy v. Ferguson.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, which, you know, establishes a separate but equal. And then you eventually finally have a Brown v. Board and cases earlier than that. You know, if it was, you know, if we said, oh, law is settled, well, Plessy v. Ferguson settled it, right? Mm-hmm. There is no such thing, right? The courts are going to interpret the law And they are going to be influenced by their ideology, and they are going to be influenced by society at the time. They are going to be influenced by, you know, many different variables. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's why I say there is a chance Roe v. Wade will be overturned.
Yeah. And that's hard news, but at the same time, it's a reality that it could happen. And in terms of, if I'm just a citizen and the Supreme Court feels so far away, is there anything that our listeners can do or private citizens can do that can help share their views and say, you know, I think this is important. I think the Supreme Court should take this into consideration. Is there any precedent or sure. ways that citizens can do that?
Well, to influence the Supreme Court, it's going to take a while. Uh-huh. Unless you have a justice, you know, for example, no one saw Scalia, you know, having a heart attack and dying, yeah. right? I mean, that no one, you know, at that time, that was a shocker. But you have to think long term. Mm-hmm. You have to think, you know, of, you know, what is your end goal? And you have to understand that change does take enormous amount of time, and you're not going to see, I mean, it's going to be a depressing message, but I'm just going to drop it in. You're not going to see immediate changes, mm-hmm. except for you're going to see them at your local level. So you need to be voting in your local elections. You need to be voting in your state, you know, for your state legislatures. You need to consider running for something, right? I think that was one of the positives that came out of the 2016 election. You had enormous amount of women that went into politics that never thought they would ever.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean,
there are positives that come out of this. So if you want to, for example, if you're concerned about abortion becoming illegal, well, guess what? You can change it at the state level. Mm-hmm. Right. Roe v. Wade just simply says the state cannot deny a woman access to that. Right. Up, you know, well, the you know, there's it's much more involved than that. But essentially, at least through the first trimester, then the state has a greater, you know, influence in the decision in by the second trimester and so on. But you can make an impact on the laws that the states are passing, right, by voting for the person that's in your state legislature. I happen to have the great privilege of being in Anna Eskamani's district, and she is one of our grads, and we're so proud of her. And you know what? She's one of those that said, I'm going to make a change, at, you know, and I'm going to make it up in state of Florida's legislature. And she has. And same thing for Carlos also is in another district. He, you know, has been doing amazing things. So consider running, right, for a local election, but certainly stay involved. I just finished up a history book club for the League of Women Voters. Mm-hmm. They don't get a lot of recognition, but they're involved in many local issues, from gun control to classroom sizes to gay marriage, and the list goes on. They don't have enough young volunteers. They need them, right? Certainly volunteer for a campaign. Mm-hmm. You know, after I'm slammed up until the middle of the week, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, I'm going to spend a couple hours, you know, helping the campaign. I swore to myself I would do everything I could in this election.
Yeah.
But it can't stop with that election. Mm-hmm. It has to continue in the off year, you know, the midterm elections. So, you know, you want to go into 2022. You want to make sure you're staying engaged. You do all of these things, first of all, as citizens of this great republic, and it is a great republic. I'm biased. I teach American history. I have that great blessing. It doesn't mean it's not without enormous amounts of faults, mm-hmm. but it has the ability to improve and change, right? We're getting ready to experience one of those moments. We get to actually make decisions as citizens, and this sometimes gets overlooked, but there are so many places in the world people don't have that opportunity.
Yeah.
I would say most important, read and read, right? Join a book group, create a book group. You know, we're now all sitting at home doing nothing, you know, stop watching cat videos, which I love to watch, right?
Yeah.
But it's, you know, read. I assure you, Ruth Bader Ginsburg did not start off thinking I'm going to be a Supreme Court justice, and perhaps considered one of the most famous Supreme Court justices in the world and in history. she started with one step at a time, right? I need to get a degree. Mm-hmm. Okay. I need to, you know, maybe law is my way of making change. So I guess to do that, maybe I should try to go to law school. Women now can do that. And remember, women were not always able to do that. That's another good conversation we can have, right? And right there where you're at in your state, Bradwell v. Illinois, very important case. But, you know, you put that, you know, you build it one step at a time or one brick at a time. I mean, you start, and it does take decades. I think of the women's rights activists, and many of them never saw women, you know, that 19th Amendment passed and ratified. Mm-hmm. But they knew their daughters might, right? And or their granddaughters. And so, and it's very difficult to spend that kind of energy working, but it's worth it. If you want the world to be the way you want it to be, right? And shape it that way. I would say my biggest concern in our politics is there's an ignorance of history. Mm-hmm. That is one of the most important elements to the success of our republic, is understanding our history. And I mean our true history.
Yeah.
Not, you know, making slavery sound, oh, it was terrible, but, you know, no, it was brutal. It was horrific. You know, and we need to teach not less of it, we need to teach more of it, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, Jim Crow, we don't need to say, well, yeah, but that's not the case anymore. But it could be.
Yeah.
And for some people, they're not able to walk in neighborhoods without fear of being shot. Mm-hmm. So I think there's enormous amounts of energy out there, but it's energy on both sides of the aisle ideologically. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's a good thing. I think it's healthy when we have truly healthy parties, two parties. I think that's a healthy, you want to have a debate and arguments, civil arguments,
yeah.
over what should be the direction of this country. Mm-hmm. Again, that comes out of, that's where compromise comes out of, right? Mm-hmm. What's part of the problem is both, and the Democrats and Republicans were both guilty of this, is the significant gerrymandering they did.
Yeah.
In the states. And so you don't have truly battleground districts, you know, where people have to moderate their, you know, what their position is. And I mean, truly moderate it, because for them to get elected, they have to appeal to a strong center. That's a good thing. So again, I don't know that that's going to make everyone happy, but I do think those are the things we have to think about. Those are the ingredients. And yeah. I would say, don't despair. I mean, I think that there is, you know, there are solutions right there in front of us, mm-hmm. right? And those solutions include just get involved.
Yeah.
So that would be my simple message as everyone finishes, you know, listening, is to make sure that, you know, you've got a month left before the election. If you're unhappy that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is no longer and she's being replaced by a conservative, okay, do something about it. Mm-hmm. No, it's not going to have an immediate effect, but you can start to lay the groundwork for that. You know, then you want to make sure you elect, in this case, a Joe Biden mm-hmm. and Kamala Harris. And by the way, in return, a Democratic Senate. If you're happy about Ginsburg being replaced by conservative, then you've got your goals, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this is where the conservatives have outpaced the Democrats. They've outpaced them in the long game.
And it is quite a long game, and it doesn't end on November 4th. It ends, you know, far, far longer than that. Or I'm not even sure if the 4th is the correct date, but, you know, that first Tuesday in November.
I don't think it's going to be anyway. I think we're going to have some, it's going to go on for a little bit, and everyone needs to go ahead and buckle up. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be a long election process. I don't think it's going to be something, and I could be completely wrong. Gosh knows, who knows what tomorrow's going to bring, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, it's just a constant news cycle, right? Mm-hmm. But I do think it's going to go on for long, you know, quite some time. And I think that's where Bush v. Gore comes back into it, that pressure.
Yeah.
How do you wrap this up? Can we wrap this up? And that was one of the things Ruth Bader Ginsburg pushed back on and her dissent, mm-hmm. you know, that this is, you know, democracy doesn't exist in, you know, in time, you know, on a timeline in that sense. You can't put it on a, you know, a time clock.
Yeah.
You know, you have to put, you know, you have to make sure you've completely looked at and examined and validated votes. So let's hope Florida's not in the thick of it at the time, but good chance it will be, as usual. So,
our producer, Mike, he loves to make jokes about Florida any times that he can, especially, you know, it being his home state.
Well, you know, I told my mom was lamenting about the fact that Florida was, you know, such a, being seen as such a disgrace in the Bush 2000 election. I told her, it's been that way. I said, think about the 1876 election. Florida was right in the middle of it too. So we got a long history of this. I don't think it made her feel better. So I don't think so.
Well, Patty, this has been an excellent interview. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
I enjoyed it.
We really appreciate your time.
Yeah, you asked me for some books. Do you want a couple of recommendations in terms of resources, if you have time? I would highly recommend everyone read Linda Kerber, mm-hmm. K-E-R-B-E-R, and I can send this to you, No Constitutional Right to Be Ladies.
Okay.
It's a very interesting talk, a book, I mean. And an overview would be Van Berkelio's Belonging to the World. That would be another one I would give some consideration to. And the rest of them I've got are like kind of textbook type of ones, but I'm always happy if anyone wants to get any other suggestions, I'm always happy to do so.
Yeah, we will definitely share those with our listeners. I'll send you a little follow-up email if you want to send me those titles. We will definitely make sure to include that. Do you have any other like questions or thoughts or anything else you wanted to go over?
No, I think just get involved. Mm-hmm. I mean, vote, first of all, first and foremost, vote. We see what people not voting results in. Remember, the idea of changing the Electoral College is never going to happen. I shouldn't say never, but is very unlikely to ever happen because you'd have to have the states ratify it. And you're not going to have those states ratify it that are benefiting from the Electoral College. So if you want to make a difference, the first things first, you've got to get out and vote. Second of all, I would say get involved. You got 3 weeks left or whatever it might be. You could do a lot in 3 weeks. And if Ruth Bader Ginsburg is what is your inspiration and you're wanting to think about her legacy may not be immediate in the courts if those change, but they can be immediate in our action at the ballot box. And if we're running, you know, it took her a long time to put those cases together in the 70s. So she didn't start off as notorious RBG, right? So you got to start little by little. And that power is with us right now. It absolutely is. I'll be happy to talk any other time. If you need help with anything, just let me know.
Oh, I really appreciate that. Thank you so much. Sure. Yeah.
Of course. Be safe, okay?
Thank you. You as well. Have a great afternoon.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. Today's show. Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments about today's episode, you can email us at sitstilllookopinionated@gmail.com. And make sure to follow us on Instagram at @sitstill_lookopinionated and on Twitter at @sitstillpodcast. And make sure to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. This podcast was produced by Michael Dritto and written by myself, Claire Malky, and Michael Dritto. Theme music by Terrence Jackson. Transition music by Christina Walter. Research by Ross Black. And of course, I'm your host, Claire Malky. See you next week. Bye.